Hello, and welcome to the DC Insider Employer Update Podcast. This podcast provides updates based on the expertise and insights from the attorneys at the Washington, D.C.-based law firm, Fortney Scott, and their guests. This podcast will provide an analysis of significant federal developments affecting the workplace that employers need to understand and is for informational purposes only and does not provide legal advice. Now let's turn it over to our hosts, David Fortney.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the DC Insider Employer Update Podcast. Really glad to have everyone joining us again today. And we have both Nita and Bert. Nita, how are you?
I'm good. It's a great day here in St. Louis.
Bert, how are you?
Just fine and glad to be back doing these podcasts.
Yes, indeed. And we've got a lot to cover. What we really want to do today is focus on the Supreme Court's docket and some of the key cases. Obviously, we can't discuss the whole docket, but we want to hone down and highlight a couple of Supreme Court cases and some other significant judicial developments that I think really help inform for employers what is on the horizon and why this promises to be another tremendously impactful year with these Supreme Court decisions that are coming down. So certainly one key point that employers, if you're not already, you need to continue to monitor and pay attention to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court term started a couple of weeks ago. October 2nd was when it kicked off. And of course, the court opens with really record low approval ratings. I mean, the court's popularity, if you will, of course, the court doesn't stand for election. Those justices all have lifetime appointments, but only 38% of Americans actually have a positive approval. And perhaps more importantly, 54% with a strong disapproval. A lot of people have different theories. Is it because of the recent ethics flaps? Is it because of the ruling in Dobbs or other rulings? Well, for our purposes, it doesn't matter. The court, although unpopular, is tremendously influential and going to drive much of society. Of course, this isn't the first time that the court has experienced, if you will, choppy waters or headwinds as it is perceived by the public. Gosh, I mean, we go back, FDR had a court problem, if you will, as he tried to enact New Deal legislation. That seemed to be resolved with the threat of maybe we'll just add some more justices. And lo and behold, the justices had a different view. Thereafter, in the mid-50s, following the Brown versus Board of Education ruling in 54, there were impeach Earl Warren, who was then the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, impeach Earl Warren billboards around the country. So I guess relatively speaking, we're perhaps not that extreme at this point, but the court is unpopular. But nonetheless, these rulings are significant coming up.
You know, the thing that struck me, David and Nita, is that the court really depends on their credibility among the American people. You know, there's that old saw, you know, how many divisions hath the Pope? The same is true of the Supreme Court. You know, how do they enforce their decisions other than the willing participation of a democratic republic? And some of these decisions are causing people to rethink whether the court under, you know, the old Marbury versus Madison, we decide what the law is. There's a possibility that that's not going to happen.
One of the interesting things, your comment about the Pope reminds me of then President Andrew Jackson asking Chief Justice Marshall, when Chief Justice Marshall said you can't move the Native Americans away, he said, Mr. Marshall, you have your law, now you enforce it. The same problem again. But I think we are seeing, to some extent, a lot of pushback on much of the federal government. And I think the court is filling a vacuum here that Congress has not been doing its job. And so the court is stepping in and seemingly deciding to interpret that.
Well, I think that's right. And let's highlight a couple of cases that we want to unpack and talk briefly about so that people know what's coming. The first, and I think, frankly, one of the most important cases of the term is Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. That provides the court the opportunity to revisit and likely, in my view, overturn the Chevron doctrine. And Chevron is a prior ruling that talks about deference to administrative agencies and regulations. We're going to unpack that and understand why that is so significant. Next case that is moving along and will be argued this term is Muldrow versus St. Louis. And that may expand the employer actions that would be actionable under Title VII. Final case that we want to touch on briefly is SEC versus Jarkissi, and that will deal with administrative enforcement schemes and ALJs, administrative law judges, which are really integral to how so many workplace laws are enforced. Well, let's kick that right off. Let's get to that first one. And Bert, let me ask the controlling question. What does a bunch of fishermen have to do with federal regulations and Chevron?
It's odd that you'd ask, but before I go swimming with the fishes, let me give everyone a little bit more background on just what the Chevron doctrine is. The issue is boils down to when does an agency, you know, OSHA or OFCCP, Wage and Hour, or even Department of Labor itself, when does an agency properly issue a regulation that implements the law but stays within the boundaries set up with the law? And this particularly matters when the law either invites interpretation or otherwise is ambiguous. Now, nearly 40 years ago, in a case called Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council, Supreme Court ruled that in those situations, the court should defer to a federal agency's expertise so long as the interpretation meets those criteria and is otherwise reasonable. This is really an example of judicial restraint. This is of the court recognizing the limits of its expertise and also establishing some limits on its own authority. It was written by Justice Stevens, perhaps the chief exemplar of restraint, for a unanimous court, 9-0, and Chevron created the ground rules for government regulation and for judicial review. In Loper Bright, the Supreme Court agreed to reconsider Chevron. So let me get to Loper Bright, this odd case. A group of commercial fishing companies challenged a regulation issued by the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is the group that controls the use of our marine resources. And the rule requires that the fishing industry pays for the costs of observers who are on their boats to monitor that the fishing boats comply with the management plan so we don't exhaust our fish and stuff like that. The companies objected to paying the fees for the monitors and claimed that the agency had no right to impose those fees. Relying on Chevron in the appellate court right here in D.C., the court rejected the company's challenge, and it was an interesting ruling. The court explained that the fishery law is clear, unambiguous, that the government can require the fishing boats to carry the monitors, although it acknowledged that the law does not specifically address who has to pay for those monitors. However, and this is where the notion of deference comes in, the court concluded that the agency's interpretation of the fishery law as requiring industry-funded monitors was reasonable in light of the rest of the law and the intent of the statute, and it deferred to the interpretation. The fishing companies objected. They're appealing to the Supreme Court, and they're asking justices both to strike down the regulation and to overrule the underlying rationale, that is to say, to overrule Chevron. It's going to be argued in the fall. The potential impact of reversing Chevron on the federal employment laws is going to be the subject of what we're going to talk about for the rest of this podcast. But the thing to understand is that modern government, the kind of the whole way our government approves drugs, issues health standards, environmental standards, accessibility rules, those are all in play. And that's why Loper is number one on the list of important cases.
I think what's really important is, I mean, this goes back to the challenge to the administrative state that's been established, which we've been using for the past at least 50, and in some cases, more like 70 years. For anyone who's an employer who's covered by these federal laws, this is a huge challenge. And I think the beginning of these challenges, you could see in the Obama overtime rules and the way that they were challenged and the raising at that point that salary basis was not in the statute. And I think Justice Gorsuch raised it in the Helix case last term that if the right case basically came up, they would look and see whether or not salary basis, which is in the regulations, is actually something in the statute. I think it's really interesting that the Supreme Court now wants to basically look at the statutes themselves and decide what was meant, not Congress, not the agencies.
I agree with you, Nita. I mean, this case goes right to the heart of the current initiative, broad-based initiative, to challenge and to, if you will, rethink, reimagine the so-called administrative state. And in plain speak, this administrative state in the world of labor and employment law, this is what it's all about. This is what over the last 50, 60 years, all the employment laws have been built out and implemented and animated through regulation, sub-regulatory guidance, growing deference to agencies. And as the laws have gotten more extended, more complicated, to your point, Congress has been less specific, fairly generalized, with the notion we'll defer and let the experts within the agencies implement and carry this out. And this raises the core question, is that proper? Is that the proper role? And there's a series of challenges that can be brought. But the question of whether the courts should defer to agencies or not, particularly when looking at a statute and interpreting the statute, core question. I think it's more likely than not this court is going to have some very specific thoughts and look primarily to the statute.
You know, one of the things that troubles me about the whole approach, the court are lawyers, they're constitutional lawyers, they are steeped in a kind of ivory tower. The whole idea that the third largest country in the world, the most complex society ever imagined, somehow or the other is supposed to be dictated to by Congress, which can't even convene, down to the specificity of health standards, drug approvals, water levels in the upper Missouri. The whole idea is to involve expertise of the entire government in running this complex society. And that seems to be running contrary to the way the court is moving.
And one other thing to think about, you know, I was an in-house counsel for 21 years. Let me tell you how much employers hate to not know what they're supposed to do. And this just throws a huge monkey wrench in the day-to-day life.
Well, I think that's right. And some of these other cases, I think, are going to pose even further challenges. So, Nita, let's talk a little bit about Muldrow versus St. Louis, a case that the court has also agreed that I think implicates Title VII and the breadth of Title VII.
That's exactly right, David. And what's really interesting about this case, first of all, Muldrow, who was a police sergeant in the St. Louis City Police Department, actually worked at one point just up the street from me. So let's talk a little bit about the police sergeant Muldrow, Jatanya Muldrow. She worked in basically the downtown office of the police department, and she had a job where she was basically providing information on human trafficking to the FBI. So it was a 9-to-5 job. She could wear regular clothes and so forth. And then she got a new supervisor. The supervisor transferred her from what was really a pretty cushy job for a policeman to the 5th District, which isn't terrible. I mean, I live here, so it's a pretty nice area. But she had to wear a regular police uniform and all the equipment, guns and all that stuff. And she was basically an administrative. It was not a great change. And basically, she was replaced by a guy who was a friend of her supervisor who'd worked for him before. So she appealed. Now, she kept her job. She kept her status. And so the real issue here was, could an involuntary transfer be considered discriminatory under Title VII? She's in the 8th Circuit. The Court of Appeals, starting with the district court, ruled she didn't lose any money. She lost. She goes to the 8th Circuit. And this is definitely a case where there's a lot of circuit difference. The 8th Circuit basically says you've got to show that there was some kind of harm, demonstrable harm. You've got the D.C. Circuit and the 6th and the 9th allow it to be actionable under certain circumstances. Then you've got the 5th and the 3rd. You've got to have an actual tangible. So you've got a real mix here. So basically is whether or not an involuntary transfer or other employment actions that don't involve hiring, firing, and promotion and don't actually have changes in money are covered by Title VII. And if you look at Title VII, let's go back to the court loves to review the statute. All that Title VII says, it prohibits discrimination with respect to compensation, terms and conditions, or privileges of employment based on your protected status. Now, Muldrow will have to prove, simply because she, I think, is a female and may, in fact, also be African-American, was transferred for that basis rather than the friendship. That's a whole different issue. But I think it's interesting to me that this court appears interested in expanding in worker rights when you would think this would be a court that is not interested in expanding worker rights, but want to help corporations. This would also impact things that employers do around DE&I. So if you transfer a white person and move a Black person into a position to give them an opportunity to get more experience, that would be actionable if they expand this law. So it's a big deal, David.
It is. And so the core concept is terms and conditions of employment. I think that the advocates for expanding that from these how the circuits have defined it, even though it's defense counsel, we like it narrow. I think it's more likely than not this court is going to read the statute and say that is what the statute says. That's what we're doing. So that's a really important point, I think, Nita, that you've emphasized for us. Don't bring your traditional conservative, liberal, look how this court has interpreted, for example, a religious discrimination. Look how it's interpreted LGBT rights in reading the statute. It is more of a statutory literalist, and it seems to want to go in that direction, irrespective of what those consequences may be.
Yeah, and you know, one of the chief reasons this case has drawn so much attention is the one that Nita alluded to, which is you could now bring cases where there is no ultimate harm. There may not even be a tangible harm. It could be a status case, and that is what puts DE&I in the target zone. It used to be only ultimate decisions were actionable under Title VII for the most part, except in the jurisdictions Nita had mentioned. Now, even if there is no tangible harm, you can claim you were discriminated against by a DEI program.
One thing I thought was interesting is that she's arguing that Ellerith has been misinterpreted by the various circuits as requiring this final action in order to actually have a case under Title VII, which I thought was kind of interesting to see. Generally, they haven't been overturning statutes. They've been reinterpreting them.
Oddly enough, the Justice Department is on her side.
Yeah. We could have a 9-0 decision just like we did in the Groff case, guys.
I would not be terribly surprised by that, honestly. So, all right. Let me just briefly touch on a couple of cases that actually arise in the securities industry, but that have much broader implications. The first involves the question of how claims are adjudicated. In the case is SEC versus Jarkessi. This is a significant case involving, again, as all these cases do, splits in the circuit. But it really goes to whether there are rights and how agencies go about enforcement. So the question of enforcement and do you have a right to go to the federal district court with a jury trial, the Seventh Amendment, a right that attaches, or can you have your rights adjudicated before an administrative law judge, an ALJ that is typically part of the same department that you are adverse to? So for federal contractors out there, think about an OFCCP enforcement proceeding in which you are having your case adjudicated before a Labor Department administrative law judge, or similarly in OSHA cases, a wide range of cases. And so when we talked before about the administrative state, one of the linchpins of that, and the reason that many of these cases do not go to federal courts, whereas other countries actually have labor tribunals, we don't. We have this primarily these administrative law judges or administrative judges for some claims that decide these cases. This is a fundamental question of whether that type of administrative law judge enforcement scheme is legitimate. And the court is likely, once again, to have some significant concerns. Another case that I want to touch on that also is from the securities industry that also deals with, again, what the statute means, administrative rights, and how they're to be resolved, is one that was just argued in the first 10 days of the court, and that's Murray versus UBS Securities. The question there, and this is more of a technical one, but it illustrates some of the points we've been talking about before. What's the burden of proof? This is a SOX retaliation case. Is it but for? Is it because of discrimination? That's what the employer argued. And I might say those arguments were ably presented by Eugene Scalia, a dear friend, and in what was his first outing before the Supreme Court? Or is it a lower standard as the courts have ruled? Interestingly, in the oral argument, bearing out some of the points that we're anticipating in these other cases, we have the three liberal justices wanting the plaintiff to have to prove a lower standard, not but for, but a lower standard, just if it was a contributing factor. And additionally, Justice Gorsuch appeared to be on the same page. Justice Gorsuch, he's noting to Mr. Scalia, who's arguing the case, well, I see discrimination in the statute. I see whistleblowing activity in the statute, but I don't see retaliation. I don't see the exact term that you're arguing for. Now, Scalia's response was, well, it says because of, and that's what the reason that you should interpret that as with this higher standard. We'll see. But once again, it's Justice Gorsuch plus the three traditional liberals, plus potentially Justice Kavanaugh or the Chief Justice, maybe both, who easily, I could imagine, going along for different reasons. The so-called liberal justices maybe like the outcome, and the others are textualists that are reading the statute.
David, in years past, we have talked about cases involving ALJs and whether they were constitutionally appointed. If the court decides that the SEC has no authority to adjudicate in an administrative context, does that mean every case that we now take to an ALJ has to go to a federal district court judge?
The answer is it depends. Certainly, there are proponents that would like to completely eliminate the entire ALJ process. Without getting into the weeds too much, there are lots of different ALJ statutory schemes, and it's possible, even with a knocking down of the SEC's ALJs, that ALJs still could survive if properly formatted and put in place.
By the way, David, I just wanted to mention, when you say SOX, you mean Sarbanes-Oxley.
I mean Sarbanes-Oxley, the SOX case. Yes, thank you. Well, Nita, there are a couple of other cases. They're not on the Supreme Court docket, but boy, they are very significant in terms of employers and particularly federal contractors and the power of the executive branch to promulgate requirements for federal contractors.
And I know our time is getting short here, but I just want to mention there are three cases working their way up to the court that could impact severely federal contractors. Now, federal contractors might like the result. The question really is, in all three cases, two of which are in front of the Court of Appeals already, is whether or not President Biden, under the Procurement Act, has the authority to issue, in these cases, a federal minimum wage for certain federal contractors. And we have in the 10th Circuit an injunction against that particular executive order that he issued for $15 minimum wage for limited numbers of federal contractor employees. So we will have to see. Basically, they're saying the Procurement Act does not cover that. And if that's true, David, it would, as we've talked about before in the federal vaccine mandate cases, that could come for our executive order 11246.
Exactly. And I think that there are many, many that are poised to potentially raise that challenge to 11246 and the entire OFCCP set of enforced obligations under that order. And the core argument is the Procurement Act. Does it really just limit itself to traditional contracting best value, how the bid process works, how contracts are awarded, or does it authorize the executive branch, the president, through issuing executive orders to promulgate more expansive obligations on federal contractors, minimum wage, vaccine obligations, affirmative action? Those are the core questions, and many courts have openly signaled a willingness to revisit the president's authority under the Procurement Act and read it more narrowly.
It's almost a classic case to go back to the definition of what Chevron was supposed to do. Do the regulations, implement the intent of the statute, and do so within the confines of the law. And the cases, Nita, you just talked about are almost exactly teed up on that question.
Right. And that's why I think all these fit together. Well, look, we are close on time, and I want to give everyone a chance for their sort of key takeaways as we try to unpack some of these Supreme Court and key developments that we're going to be monitoring. So, Bert, let me start with you.
Wow. Let me use some fancy language. I think we're going to see a Supreme Court relying on terms like originalism and literalism, but what they're really doing is imposing their own vision of this 18th century Constitution on a 21st century society, and we will see what the impact of that is.
Nita?
Well, I think this court so far has been a disruptor of the workplace laws as we have known them, overturning decades of expectations about affirmative action, potentially federal contracting, diversity and inclusion, and potentially overtime, wage hour, and others. It's going to be very interesting to see where this goes.
Well, I think that the court is likely to continue to expand civil rights, notwithstanding the popular perception of a, quote, conservative court, because of the literal reading of the statute. And I think the same fate is going to result to the administrative state, because the statute will be interpreted as, quote, not authorizing that, and the consequences be damned, they're going to go forward with that. So we will see, and obviously we will be reporting out as those decisions come forward. Promises to be a really impactful year in terms of the judicial cases. So, Nita, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Bert?
Yeah, always a pleasure, even with those sobering thoughts.
Yes, well, thanks. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in to another edition of the DC Insider Employer Update Podcast. If you're not already a subscriber, please do push that subscriber button. You can do that on Spotify, Apple, wherever you secure your podcasts. Thanks, everyone. We look forward to talking to you in the future. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for listening to the DC Insider Employer Update. The podcast that provides analysis of significant federal developments affecting the workplace that employers need to understand. You can subscribe to the DC Insider Employer Update podcast wherever you get your podcasts, which includes Apple, Spotify, and Google. Additional information about our podcast is located on the Fortney Scott website at fortneyscott.com. Thanks again for listening to the DC Insider Employer Update.